Hello, and thank you for downloading this episode of Radio Grimbald from RadioGrimbald.com. I am your host, Goldeen Ogawa, and welcome to the 11th episode of Radio Grimbald. Coming up today on the show, it's The Amazing Mages, the 6th Bo Ragnar Phelps adventure. For those of you just joining us, I am Goldeen Ogawa, and this season on Radio Grimbald, I am reading stories from the first volume of The Adventures of Bo Ragnar Phelps. Though all these stories are pretty well self-contained, if you're curious about the world and the characters, just head over to RadioGrimbald.com and click through to the episode directory for a full list of available episodes in the recommended listening order. Also worth noting that these are fantasy stories set in an all-original fantasy land. As such, though there are fundamental similarities to our own world, I expect you will notice some discrepancies in the names, places, religions, and especially the accents. As for this particular story, if you've been listening faithfully, it should be pretty obvious, it certainly isn't a secret, that these stories owe a lot to the work of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, namely his Sherlock Holmes series. I had wanted to write fantasy, but not the traditional sword and sorcery sort. I remembered Holmes saying something to the effect that he had never met a murderer who could fly, and I thought, oh, but if there's magic involved, there could be. And thus inspired, I ran off to write my own mysteries, but this time with magic involved. I'm mentioning all this because I don't think it's really fair not to. People tend to notice similarities in my work with other, greater writers. Some of these similarities are subconscious. I had read their book many times, and certain themes became ingrained in my mind and popped in without my meaning them to. Some of them were accidental. I had never even heard of this person or read their books. The similarities were simply coincidental. And some were deliberate. These I feel I should be honest about, since I was consciously helped along by some other person's work. And I'm mentioning it particularly now because the following story was directly inspired by one of my very favorite Sherlock Holmes tales. I won't tell you which one. I don't want to spoil the surprise. But fans of Holmes should easily recognize the, let's call it the armature of this story. The details, the flesh, skin, hair, and coloration, however, are entirely my own. And the solution, I am happy to say, is actually rather different. With all that in mind, Radio Grimbald is proud to present The Amazing Mages, copyright 2012 by Goldeen Ogawa. Why not write about the mages? Phelps asked me the other day as I was collecting material for these stories.
The case had certain merits, and it always struck me as dramatic. You also have been rather dramatic in these retellings. That story should be as good as a play once you have had your way with it.
To be honest, I felt this was an unfair accusation. For all I have attempted in writing down the adventures of my youth in these vignettes is to give my readers an accurate account of what really happened and how it felt to be there. If what really happened and how it felt was exciting and dramatic, then the blame rests squarely on the shoulders of my guardian, Mr. Bo Ragnar Phelps. To illustrate this, I shall take Phelps's suggestion and write about Miss Mage and the mystery she brought with her. It was in the spring of 83, and I had been living in the care of my guardian for a good 2 years. In that time, I had come to terms with his eccentric habits, from his purple clothes to his dawn runs in the park. I had also glimpsed his skills as a magician, which were impressive, if not a little frightening. My late parents had given me a good education, but it had included only the most pedestrian knowledge of magic, so anything he did or dealt with came as a surprise to me.
To Phelps this was their greatest shortcoming, and if they had not been recently departed, I fancy he would have criticized them severely. As it was, he contrived to give me magic lessons once a week in the sitting room, which was something of a trial for both of us. "Explain to me, Corianne," he said one sunny morning in early April, "what you remember about demons." "Demons," I said, trying to dredge up from the depths of my mind what had been pounded into it the week before. "Are what came before sentient life? They can cross freely between life and death and fear only the void from which they came. They live in a world apart from us, and when they come here, they take bodies of their own choosing and creation." Phelps looked at me expectantly. I racked my brains. "Look odd when they come here?"
"Odd," said Phelps with gravity, "would be an understatement. They do not merely look odd, Corianne. They feel odd. They feel wrong, like they do not belong here. Which they don't. It is like looking at a living animal that has been turned inside out. Disturbing and not at all pleasant. That is a sign of a true demon, one of the other kind, as the dragons call them. Now, what are the other sorts of demons?"
"Elemental spirits," I said, on firmer ground now. "Wind wraiths and fire spirits are often called demons, but they're not really. Also some magical animals and monsters. Demon can also be a euphemism for an unwanted mental attribute of a person, and the title of a fallen angel."
"Or," Phelps finished for me, "a child of the devil."
"But isn't the devil a fallen angel?" I asked a little timidly. Though I had a good portion of the Etherealist Bible behind me, I also knew that Phelps was sceptical of that religion, and was probably familiar with all its shortcomings.
"Indeed."
"No,"
said Phelps.
"He is one of the other kind."
There was a knock on the door. Phelps, who had sat up straight and raised a hand, seeming about to say something important, crumpled back down upon himself and shot a disgruntled look at the door.
"What is it?" he called.
The door clicked open softly, revealing our housekeeper, Mrs. Bryce, a silver tray in her hand with a small white card on it. She was a large woman, tall and wide, with rusty grey hair and dark eyes. She did not speak much, and I seldom saw her. But now she strode into the room and thrust the tray under Phelps's nose. Phelps eyed the tray and the card it carried. He sniffed, wrinkling his brow.
"I don't want that," he said. "It's urgent," said Mrs. Bryce in her low, calm voice.
And if anything could have convinced Phelps of said urgency, it was the fact that she had spoken. He sighed, plucked the card from the tray, and examined it. One of his eyebrows went up, wrinkling half his forehead, and he shrugged to himself.
"We're in luck, Corianne," he said. "Someone has come to steal us away from our dreaded magic lesson." "Well?" "Show her up, Mrs. Bryce, and lose not a moment. Like you said, the matter must be urgent."
And when she had left the room again, he tossed me the card and said,
"What do you make of it?"
The card was of good paper, but old and a little bent, as if it had been folded at one time and then carefully flattened. It was also handwritten instead of printed, in a flowery hand with so many flourishes and dots that at first it was difficult to make out the words. These said, once I had deciphered them, "The Amazing Mage," in large arching letters across the top, and "Children," in small, tasteful italics. Flipping it over, I found the name Vitronica Mage, sloppily printed in pencil. "It's an old card," I said.
"Obviously,"
said Phelps, as though I had said something painfully stupid.
"So it is not the Amazing Mage who will be visiting us, but this Vitronica. One of the children, perhaps?"
But when the door was opened once again and our visitor appeared, she was not a child. She was a young woman, flustered and white-faced, wearing such a costume as I had never seen outside the theatre. An old and patched dress that had once been very fine, but had gone out of fashion 20 years ago or more. She had two different shoes, one soiled white cuff, the other a more sensible fawn colour, and a fine velvet cloak of deep blue, with a brilliant scarlet lining that was hemmed with gold brocade. Her wheat-coloured hair had been hastily bundled up under a wide-brimmed hat that had the better part of an ostrich's tail sewn to the band, and from under this shaking fringe she stared at us with intense, pale blue eyes. "You are Mr. Phelps?" she asked, her gaze fixed upon my guardian. "You are the Purple Magician." I have remarked in my memoirs on my guardian's penchant for purple clothing, and I had heard him referred to before as the Purple Gentleman, but never as the Purple Magician, and certainly not with the careful pronunciation and intensity that this young woman, Vitronica Mage, said it now. Phelps, who had been regarding her with mild boredom, sat up a little straighter and turned to face her fully. "I am," he said, in a soft voice that filled the little room. "Please, I beg you to sit down and tell us what troubles you. Oh," he added as Vitronica Mage shot me a worried look. "This is my ward, Miss Corianne Birch. No need to cut words because of her. She has my complete confidence." With a look of trepidation, Vitronica Mage took a seat across the room from us, collapsing into it with the same graceless attitude that Phelps was wont to use at times. Then, seeming to remember her manners at the last moment, she straightened her back and smoothed her skirts before addressing us. "Mr. Phelps," she began, "I have called on you today because, well, that is to say, I... Oh!" She clenched her gloved fists in frustration. "I am afraid, terrified actually, that my life is in danger."
"Be calm, Miss Mage," said Phelps, all gentle reassurance. "Whatever danger you fear cannot reach you here."
Miss Mage gulped and took several deep, steadying breaths.
"Now," continued Phelps, "tell us your story, and I should be very much surprised if I cannot help you."
Miss Mage smoothed down her skirts once more, and then made a distracted gesture as if to sweep her hand through her hair, only to find this action prohibited by her hat, so she simply hooked a stray strand behind her ear.
"The matter is a most complicated one," said our visitor. "I think, yes, I should begin at the very beginning. I hope you will bear with me."
Beauregna Phelps smiled indulgently.
"My name is Vitronica Mage," she began. "But you know that already. My father was the Amazing Mage. That is his card, the one I sent you, from when I was a baby. Mother wrote them out for him before she became too famous and busy. She was an artist. Mercy Mage Calhoun. Perhaps you have heard the name? No. She was quite famous in her time, or so they told me. Painted portraits of famous people from all over the world. But she died when I was still very young, and my father raised us on his own. There were 4 of us in the beginning. I was the youngest. I had 2 older brothers, Bracta and Saul, and the oldest, my sister Mirth. My father was a travelling stage magician, sleight-of-hand artist, performer, I'm not sure what they're called these days. But he did magic tricks, only without using any magic. Do you understand what I'm saying?"
Phelps nodded.
"I have met people of such profession before. Pray continue."
"It was not that he could not do magic, real magic, I mean," she said earnestly. "He merely chose not to, as a part of the performance. As a result, well, my siblings and I learned little of practical magic, though a great deal about stage magic, and we were all included in the show as soon as we were old enough. It was a busy life, moving from city to city, following the carnivals and the circuses, but very rewarding and, if I do say so myself, we were quite successful. Then my mother died suddenly. She was abroad when it happened, and I was only 7 at the time, so I was never told all the details, but Mirth, who was like a second mother to us all, said that it was an accident with a steamship. We all took the loss very ill, but none worse than our father. His health started to decline rapidly, and he died within a year. Needless to say, we were all grief-stricken, but not bereft. We had done quite well, and my mother had left us her fortune in its entirety, which was a considerable sum. However, there was a provision that we should not get our share until we each reached the age of 21 years, and until that time we were placed in the care of our uncle, my mother's brother, in Sherndale. It is difficult for me to speak ill of him, as he did take us in our hour of need and provided us with the first solid home we had ever known. But I fear I must, for it is his behaviour that has driven me to seek you out. His name is Hollis Calhoun, and he was an alchemist by profession, at least until we came to live with him at Brackenhill, his estate outside Sherndale. Both our parents' wills provided generously for our guardian as long as we were in his care, and when we arrived, he announced he was giving up his practice to devote all his energy to our well-being. A noble thing, and I can assure you that my siblings and I thought him a veritable hero in the beginning. But he was not, Mr. Phelps. He was not. He was impatient and unpredictable. He would grow frighteningly angry over the most trivial things, and on many occasions became physically violent.
Violent? Phelps interrupted. He leaned forward in his seat, his eyes with a hard glint in them. Miss Mage nodded curtly.
He has a controlling nature, and as children of travelling performers we are all somewhat free of spirit, shall we say. When he caught us at anything he thought inappropriate, he would lock us in the cellar. We often resisted this, and there was conflict. Especially with my brothers, they had it hardest of all. But it didn't become really bad until Mirth's 21st birthday. That was when she disappeared.
She disappeared? Phelps echoed.
Yes, said Miss Mage. On the morning of her birthday, she was simply gone.
Outside, in the street, there was a sharp clap of shod hooves on cobblestones as a horse took surprise at something unknown, and Miss Mage jumped in her seat so violently I thought she might have been bitten by an insect.
"Please, do not be frightened," Phelps said softly. "You are safe here, I assure you. Now, I beg, tell me exactly what you remember about your sister's disappearance. Leave no detail out."
Miss Mage twined her hands in her lap and looked about unhappily.
"That is the trouble, sir. There seemed nothing at all out of the ordinary. Everything was perfectly normal, except that in the morning she was gone."
"Had her bed been slept in?"
"Yes, and the washbasin used and her best dress missing. It appeared as though she had gotten up, dressed for the occasion, and then simply gone."
"Occasion?" Phelps probed.
"A birthday party," Mage said, and her voice wobbled.
Phelps waved his hand impatiently, and a silk handkerchief appeared in mine. I passed it to Miss Mage, who took it, thankfully.
"We'd been all week preparing it, with cakes and punches and presents, and our solicitor was coming to give Mirth a paper so she could claim her inheritance. Only she wasn't there any more. We searched all over the house, and our uncle even called the police and the sweepers, but they could find nothing."
Miss Mage blew her nose noisily into the handkerchief, and I found another had magically appeared in my hand. I glanced at Phelps, who merely jerked his head in the direction of our guest. Sighing, I passed it to her, and she took it, wiping carefully at her eyes, which had grown rather red.
"Eventually they came to the conclusion that she must have been kidnapped. Though for several weeks afterwards we all secretly hoped she had simply run away and would come back. But she never did."
"And what happened after?"
Our lives continued much as they had. Only we were all very downcast, especially Saul. He took it very badly and was even ill with a fever for several weeks. Bracta did his best to cheer us up. Since he was the eldest then, I think he saw it as his duty to set a good example. He even got a job in the village running errands and managed to earn a nice allowance, which he hid behind a loose brick in his room. He always told us if things got really bad, we could make a run for it and start our own act, like we had always planned. I think he suspected something was amiss, but he never spoke of it openly.
And your uncle? What did he do during this time?
He was not particularly concerned with us for a while, and this was a mercy. He would spend most of his day locked in his study, only coming out for meals or to get a book from the library. That only lasted for a few months, though, and when he emerged for good, he quickly put an end to Bracta's job and stopped our allowance for 3 weeks. Bracta got into a fight with him about that, and it was only by a clever diversion that Saul and I stopped him from getting hurt. So we continued, miserably, until 2 years later when Bracta turned 21.
Did he too vanish?
Phelps asked. Miss Mage nodded tightly, but her eyes were dry and hard now, and she seemed to have her emotions under control. It was just as it was with my dear Mirth. He simply vanished in the night. But this I do remember. On the evening before, he gathered us in his room and gave us each half his savings from the errand jobs he had run and told us if we ever felt ourselves to be in danger, we were to run away and never come back. Then he shooed us out of his room and locked himself in, an act which was most unusual. And I remember in the morning, when we came looking for him, there was a smell in his room like I'd never smelled before. It was terrible, like an egg that has gone bad, but sharp at the same time, like vinegar. Phelps leaned forward, his eyes sparkling, and put the tips of his fingers together.
Brimstone? He asked.
I have never smelled that, Miss Mage admitted. But if you say so. It was terribly persistent, too, and my uncle made Saul and myself clean the room 3 times over to get rid of it.
What was the official conclusion regarding your brother's disappearance?
Same as my sister, that he had run away.
You said that he locked himself in. Was the room still locked on the morning of his disappearance?
Yes, as a matter of fact. We were half the morning trying to pick it before the locksmith got there, but once we got in we found one of his windows wide open.
And did the sweepers detect anything at all this time?
No. My uncle was satisfied that Bracta had simply run away and he saw no need to call them.
Phelps tuttered.
Continue, said he.
Miss Mage twined the handkerchief around her fingers until it was twisted into a rope, then carefully flattened it again.
Saul and I were alone together, for my uncle practically ignored us. Worse, he forbade visits with our friends in the village and became so violently unpredictable that many of the servants left. Saul and I ended up doing all the work around the house, some of which we were most inept at, and whenever we failed to do something satisfactorily, my uncle would lock us in the cellar. Once, Saul failed to polish all the silver in one afternoon and was summarily locked up. When he was let out in the morning, he came straight to me, all white and trembling. He said that while he was in the cellar, he had smelled that bad egg smell, brimstone you called it, that had permeated Bracta's room on the morning of his disappearance. It was just a smell, but it brought back such bad memories that he was ill for the rest of the week. Then, almost a year and a half ago now, Saul ran away. It was on the eve of his 21st birthday, and he had become convinced that something terrible would befall him if he stayed. So he managed to sneak a letter to an acquaintance in Sherndale asking for help, and arranged to meet this person on the edge of the grounds. He took with him his share of Bracta's secret earnings, and promised to come back for me once he had gotten help from outside. I have not seen him since. And though my uncle again arranged a search party, nothing could be found of him. I do not know if this is a good sign or ill, but I have faithfully waited for him, hoping for the best. Our visitor fell silent, and in the distance I could faintly hear the ticking of the grandfather clock in the hall.
An intriguing story, and a grim one,
Phelps said, knitting his fingers together.
Certainly it has some aspects that are worthy of attention. Attention I should be happy to provide. But why have you come now, Miss Mage, and in such a state of distress?
Sir, I have waited for my brother for a year and a half, and gladly I would wait that time all over again, but I cannot wait any longer. You see, my 21st birthday is tomorrow. Even though it was a sunny spring day and there was a comfortable fire in the hearth, I could not help but feel a chill run down my spine and settle somewhere in my gut. Phelps remained composed, however, and arched an eyebrow.
"That does leave us at least a little time to solve this mystery," he remarked, "though you have left it rather late."
"I had no choice," Miss Mage explained. "My uncle has been watching me closely in recent weeks, but at last he has gone into one of his reclusive phases where he locks himself in his study for days on end, and I took the chance to slip away. I got a lift on a farm cart headed to town and used the money Bractor left me to take the train here."
"May I ask how you came to call upon me?"
"Oh," Miss Mage coloured a little, and the feathers in her hat fluttered violently. "It was the stories, you see. Father always told us stories about the purple magician, and all I had to do once I got here was ask the conductor, who kindly pointed me to a little boy hanging about the station who was able to give me your exact address. And now that I am here, and I have told you my story, can you help me? I only have a little money left to give you, but if I am still here when I turn 21,
Phelps held up a hand to stop her. "Do not let matters of finance concern you," said he. "We shall let that fall into its own place. More importantly, I think it would be best if you were well away from your uncle's house and in good company on the eve of your birthday. Do you have any friends with whom you could stay?"
"Alas, no," said Miss Mage. "I have been quite isolated for the past few years, and besides, all the villagers think the house is cursed. At least that is what the farmer who gave me a lift to the station said. Also, I fear my uncle would notice if I were gone more than a day. Perhaps he has noticed already." Phelps's brow crinkled into a thoughtful frown, and he pressed his forefinger to his mouth.
"The difficulty," he said, "is keeping you safe while at the same time conducting an investigation. From what you have told me, it could be all manner of things. A fairy, a witch, a ghoul, even a demon. All those things have been known to abduct humans. Did you ever hear any bells on the nights of the disappearances?"
"Bells?" said Miss Mage. "No, none at all."
"Which is inconclusive,"
Phelps muttered to himself. He got up, made a circuit of his own chair, then stood behind it and grasped the backrest.
"Did you ever feel anything odd? An ache behind your teeth, someone walking on your grave?"
Miss Mage shrugged. "I have no magic of my own," she said. "I would not know."
"You have had no magical training, you mean?"
Phelps said.
"Corian here is the same, but she can at least sense when something magical is going on, and something very magical is going on here."
"No, sir, you mistake," Miss Mage explained. "I do not have any magic at all. I am an unmagical person, sir. My uncle calls it magical repression." Phelps looked sharply at Miss Mage from across his chair. Then he swooped around and knelt before her, causing the poor woman to jerk backwards in surprise.
"Fascinating,"
he whispered, and made a strange motion, as though he were drawing a thread out of a spool and winding it around his finger. Miss Mage blinked and straightened her hat. "Phelps?" I asked. Phelps stood up. He made a tossing motion as though discarding something and stuffed his hands into his pockets.
"I think I would like to meet your uncle," he said quietly. "He seems a most devious man."
"I don't think that would be a good idea," Miss Mage said quietly. "He doesn't like visitors."
"With the tricks he has going, I should not be surprised," Phelps said. "Well, first things first, We must get you back home before he discovers you are gone, and I must make some inquiries of my own.
But, sir, cried Miss Mage, rising halfway to her feet, can you not tell me anything now? Any hint or clue as to the fate of my brothers and sister?
You yourself have provided me with several, said Phelps.
He wandered over to the wardrobe on the far side of the sitting room and opened its doors wide so to lean inside bodily and rummage in its contents. From within he continued speaking, his voice muffled.
But it is far too early to be drawing conclusions. All I can say is that you are indeed in some danger. Ah!
Finding what he had been searching for, Phelps withdrew from the wardrobe, holding a dull, brown cashmere shawl. Shaking the dust off it, he presented it to Miss Mage, who received it with a look of bewilderment.
That will provide you with a little protection,
Phelps explained.
Best if you keep it on you always. Now, it is time for you to get back to Bracken Hill as quickly as you can. The 11:23 from Bodsworth would do nicely, I think. In the meanwhile, Miss Birch and I have our own investigations to conduct, but would it be possible for us to visit this afternoon without your uncle's knowledge?
This afternoon? I expect so, Miss Mage said hopefully, rising from her seat and wrapping the shawl around her shoulders, where it clashed oddly with her otherwise colourful attire. If he has not come out of his study by the time I return, I doubt he will for another day. If all is well, I will meet you at the gate.
We shall see you then,
Phelps said, and gave her a handsome bow before striding out of the room, leaving me to see our guest to the door.
Don't worry, I said, shaking her hand. He may seem utterly inscrutable, but he'll work things out before long. You'll see.
Phelps was in his study when I returned, tearing through his filing drawers so that parchment and paper went flying everywhere. Finding what he wanted, a long, thin book bound in pale blue, he stood up and made to exit the room. I had to catch him by the elbow to get his attention, which was distant and vague even when I had it.
William Bazelon,
he said.
He'll know all about this case, and I need to see the mother's will.
Sir, I said, tugging insistently at his sleeve. What has happened? Do you know what the danger is? And what did you do to her?
Do?
Phelps said, his eyes becoming more focused.
I did nothing to her. I removed a malicious restraining spell.
Restraining spell?
Phelps tucked the book under his arm and sighed.
All of us, Corian, have a sense for magic. Our world is so permeated by it that it is an essential part of our survival. Not to have it is a serious disability, like being blind or deaf. Miss Mage not only has very little practical magic of her own, but she was without even this basic ability. On a closer inspection, I discovered she was under a restraining spell, and I removed it. She won't have any more magic to her name, but at least now she will be able to sense things.
Do you think it will help? I asked.
Indubitably. What the danger is, however, I do not know. I have some visits to make before we depart for Sherndale, which will hopefully illuminate this matter somewhat. In the meantime, Corian, I have an assignment for you.
An assignment?
Yes.
Phelps drew the book out from under his arm and opened it to a place in the middle. Running his finger down the page, he paused and then handed the book to me. Indicating a line, he said,
Read that aloud.
I looked at it. It was a sentence in a strange language I had never seen before, but I did my best.
Camort vehenced ulis, I said.
Phelps winced.
Oh, what does it mean? I asked.
It is a salutation of sorts,
Phelps said, taking the book back.
Now, repeat those words from memory.
I opened my mouth to do so, and I found that I couldn't. The words, which I had just read so clearly upon the page, were now gone from my head, as though they had faded away once I had read them. I gasped.
I don't remember, I admitted with equal shame and surprise. Phelps shrugged.
That is only natural. It is not a language meant for humans. Here.
He handed me the book again.
Page 44, line 7. Try to have them memorized by noon. I will meet you at Paddlefield for the 12:47 to Sherndale.
And in a whirl of purple, he was out the door and thumping down the stairs. Phelps was as good as his word, and by 10 minutes to the hour we were southbound to Sherndale with a compartment all to ourselves.
Do you have the words?
He asked me once we were settled. For one horrible moment I thought I had forgotten them. But no, they were still there, in the very back and bottom of my head. I sighed in relief and nodded. It had been a difficult assignment. The words from the book slipped out of my mind as soon as I had them out of sight, and it was only by counting the lines down from the top that I was able to find the one which Phelps wished me to memorize. But after nearly an hour of carefully reading and rereading, I found that the words began to linger in my head, like a distant echo, and after that they became stronger and stronger the more I repeated them. Now they hung there, like a faint image just on the edge of recollection.
"Well, Corianne," he said with a sigh, leaning back in his seat, "it is a most unfortunate state of affairs."
"You saw your Mr. Bazelon?" Phelps nodded.
"Indeed I did. Very informative. He knew all about the mage children. In fact, several of his colleagues have tried to open up a case against this man, Calhoun. But as he appears to have broken no law, they have been quite unable to do so. I did get a chance to see their parents' wills, however, and this shed some light upon the matter. Hollis Calhoun was rather poorly off before the children came to live with him, but as their guardian he received a hefty allowance per annum. Each child, at their coming of age, would receive £1,000, with an additional £500 yearly for the next 10 years. Because of this, Mr. Calhoun's allowance would be depleted sharply each time he lost a child to coming of age. But in the event of a child's death or disappearance, well, it states quite clearly that in the event of the death of any of the children before their 21st birthday, all the money and property they would receive would pass to Mr. Hollis Calhoun.
I let out a low whistle. That is fearful strong motive.
Indeed, said Phelps. Quite damning, really.
But have you any idea at all how he is doing it? The disappearances, or... And I paused before voicing a dark thought that had been troubling me. Do you think they're actually dead?
That...
Phelps said, putting his hands behind his head and stretching luxuriantly.
Is what I hope to uncover tonight.
He smiled and shot me a significant glance, a sly glimmer in his eye that spoke of mysterious plans and hair-raising adventure. The Brackenhill estate was some 5 miles outside of Sherndale, cloaked in trees and ivy. After dismissing our ride, we walked the remaining distance up to the grand wrought-iron gate, to where a pedestrian gate was hidden beside the main one, obscured by the tendrils of a weeping willow. Miss Mage was already in the process of opening it for us, and she greeted us nervously.
"Has all been well?"
Phelps asked, striding up. "Well enough, sir, well enough," she said, ushering us through. "Uncle has not so much as put his nose out of his study all day."
"Come, Miss Mage, you are white as a sheet. Has something happened?"
She was white as a sheet, I saw when I passed through the gate. Brushing weeping willow out of my eyes, I also saw she was trembling slightly. "Am I?" she said, putting her hands to her cheeks, as though she expected to feel the paleness. "I have taken quite a turn recently, I have to admit. It is my room, Mr. Phelps. My room does not feel the same any more." Phelps, who had been standing just inside the gate, staring off into the distance where a few of the high windows of Brackenhill were visible through the treetops, snapped his eyes back down to us.
I thought as much, he said with satisfaction. Tell me,
he said, gesturing for Miss Mage to lead the way.
Tell me everything you felt.
It was most peculiar, she said, once we had started down the overgrown drive. As though someone were watching me. And then, the longer I stayed in my room, the more it began to feel as though someone were actually there. I cannot explain how I felt this, and I do not know why, for I turned my room inside out and could find nothing and no one.
Ah, yes, said Phelps. That is to be expected.
Expected? She cried, glancing back at him in consternation. Expected of what?
Magic, Miss Mage. You have had your first conscious encounter with practical magic.
The young woman twisted her face into a grimace. I think I prefer the stage variety, she said. I gave her a comforting pat on the arm. It just takes a little getting used to, I reassured her. Our friend sighed and hurried on up the drive, where the house had come into view. When we arrived, she opened the front door and ushered us inside, but Phelps remained on the threshold, peering into the dark hall. Mr. Phelps, she asked, please do come in. Phelps shook his head.
I fear that would be most unwise, at least for me. No, I shall satisfy my curiosity from the outside only.
But, I protested, what of her room, the cellar, the whole house?
That I leave to you, dear Corianne, Phelps said simply. And I want a detailed report, so make a thorough investigation. Examine every inch, leave no stone unturned, all those things. I will see you this evening. Good day.
He tipped his hat to both of us and stalked away out of sight. We stared after him, speechless, myself with half a mind to run after him and drag him back inside by his coattails, if necessary. But it occurred to me that perhaps I ought to follow the advice I had given Miss Mage that very morning and trust my guardian. So I squared my shoulders, breathed deeply, and gestured to Miss Mage in my best Phelpsian manner. Shall we start with your room, then? Her room was on the second floor, up a flight of stairs that creaked loudly with every step. Upon entering it, the first thing I was struck by was the mess, for it was in an even worse state of disarray than our sitting room. Clothes, shoes, dishes, and books littered the floor, and her wardrobe was open with half its contents thrown over the bed. Carefully stepping inside, I caught sight of her dressing table, and its mirror was turned to such an angle that I could see myself in it, and the doorway behind me. In the reflected doorway I saw a thin man with ginger hair and a shabby evening coat staring back at me, and there was such a look of hatred and ferocity in his pale brown eyes that I whirled around in fright. But there was no one in the doorway, and when I checked the mirror again it was empty once more. There was nothing else of interest in Miss Mage's room. Though I did my best to pick through the clutter, I found nothing out of the ordinary, save the feeling of being watched, which, in conjunction with the sight in the mirror, made me extremely uncomfortable. Upon her suggestion, we looked in her siblings' old rooms, but there I found nothing but dust, cobwebs, and a feeling of lonely despair. "And the cellar?" I asked. Miss Mage twisted her skirts unhappily. "It's not nice down there," she said. "Come," I said, trying to sound reassuring. "Phelps did ask me to make a thorough investigation, and don't worry, I have some experience with cellars." She did not look reassured, but nonetheless she reluctantly led me down, until we reached a large wooden door that looked like it would have been moored home in a medieval dungeon. The iron bars that crossed its face were streaked with rust, and the wood was water-stained and rotting at the base. A heavy padlock and chain hung on a hook to one side, and this, I gathered, was Hollis Calhoun's method of locking the door, for the handle was a simple latch with no deadbolt. Gingerly, Miss Mage pushed the door open, and, in the light of the lantern she held aloft, I could see stone steps leading down a narrow stone corridor. Taking the light from her, I led the way, treading carefully, for the stones were wet. I began to feel dizzy on the second step. It started as a faint ache in my temples and grew until I could barely see straight. By the third step, I was having difficulty making sense of what the dim, shaking lantern light showed, and when I reached the fourth, I was nearly overcome by nausea. I stopped, my free hand clutching my belly, and tried to take deep, calming breaths. A smell filled my nostrils then. It was not an unpleasant smell, cold and crisp, like an open moor on a winter morning. It should have been refreshing, but was so misplaced and at odds with that dark, dank cellar that it gave me quite a turn. I looked up, intending to reassure myself that we were, indeed, underground, but what I saw was not reassuring at all. There were two visions before my eyes. One, the familiar dark cellar with its stone steps and water-stained walls, was being pushed aside and stretched thin by the other, a rocky, rutted road that cut through a field of pale green grass. In the distance were ragged mountains that looked as though something had pushed them out of shape. Above the road was a pale sky dotted with even paler clouds, and in the sky, among the clouds, dark shapes were flying. For a moment I felt a chill wind touch my face. I think I tried to scream, to call for help. Certainly I made a strangled sound at the back of my throat that Miss Mage, being a sensible woman, took to mean I was in trouble. She grasped me under the arms and half-pulled, half-dragged me back up the steps, out of the cellar, and away from that distant, terrifying road. The cellar door clanged shut, and once again I was back in the house, cold, shivering, and gasping for breath.
"A road?"
Phelps asked when I came to tell him about my findings. We were in Sherndale's best inn, lingering over a dinner that neither of us had taken much advantage of. "A road," I repeated, and told him in detail my experience in the cellar.
"And our friend, Vetronica Mage, did she see it as well?"
I shook my head. "No, nor did she feel nauseated like I did, though she said she felt a bit dizzy." Phelps leaned back in his chair and crossed his legs. He surveyed our dinner through half-lidded eyes, as though he expected to find the answer to our mystery hidden amongst the napkins and the silverware.
"This is a fragile case," he said softly. "Tread too heavily, and we may break it."
"What do you mean by that?" Phelps looked up at me sharply and narrowed his eyes.
"Corian, might I ask you to do me a great favour? It will require a good deal of nerve, may in fact be rather dangerous, but I have no doubt you could handle it with ease."
"Please," I said, "name it."
"I need you to stay with Miss Mage tonight, in her room at Bracken Hill."
"Me?" I exclaimed, filled with alarm. "Why me?"
"Her uncle may be out of sight, Corian, but that does not make him oblivious. Even going round the outside of the house, I had to carefully dismantle several watching spells so he would not perceive my presence. The interior, I could tell from my brief glance, was packed with them. That apparition you glimpsed in her mirror was most certainly one of them. If he sees me, I have no doubt he would not go through with whatever it is he is doing to these poor children, and we would not be able to catch him at it."
"Why?" I asked, a little chilled. "Must we catch him at it? Shouldn't we go there right now and stop him?"
"If we stopped him, we would never know exactly what he is doing. The road you saw, Corian, was real. It was a fairy road, though other things besides fairies use them. Such roads run in and out and around this world, and many magical beings use them when paying visits here. From this, I suspect our uncle has summoned one of these creatures to spirit the children away."
"Spirited away? Then you do not think they are dead?"
I highly doubt it, Phelps said with a shrug. But it is only a theory, and though I have no doubt I could stop him doing it now, if we do not catch what it is that has taken poor Vetronica Mage's siblings away, there is no hope we will ever have them return to us.
Returned? Do you think you could do that?
I think it is certainly worth a try, and perfectly possible, if I have your help. Well, Corian, are you game?
There was a challenging glint in his eye as he spoke, and it lit in me once again the fiery thrill of adventure. You have my word, I said.
I was regretting it soon after, when we had left the comfort of the inn and were walking back to Bracken Hill in the evening twilight, for it is all very well to make brave promises in a warm, well-lit room, but it is another thing entirely to keep them when you are walking through a shadowy landscape where every crack and rattle in the hedges might be a fearsome monster, and every dim gully or ditch could be hiding a slimy hand ready to reach up and pull you under.
Phelps, I asked, trying to keep the tremor out of my voice, what sort of thing do you expect her uncle to summon?
Phelps considered this.
I have at present 4 likely candidates, all of whom could and probably would willingly kidnap the children with little convincing. A fairy, obviously, since it was a fairy road you discovered. Perhaps a ghoul, and that would be unfortunate. Things left alone around ghouls tend to end up dead. If we are lucky, he is summoning an elf. And if we are very unlucky indeed, he is summoning a demon.
A demon? I repeated, alarmed.
Demons walk the fairy roads,
Phelps explained mildly.
The ones that can walk, in any case. Some slither, others crawl. Some just ooze.
My mind raced back to our lesson this morning, how long ago that seemed now, and remembered the things I had been told about demons. I felt a little ill.
But if he summons a demon,
then you shall be there.
But
I gesticulated wildly with my hands, full of alarm.
A demon!
Do you still have the words I gave you?
I paused, tensed for a moment, and then relaxed again as I found them, snugly tucked away in the back of my head.
Yes, I said.
Then you have nothing to worry about,
Phelps said cheerfully, and not another word did he speak until we reached the gates of Bracken Hill. There he stopped and stood aside while I let myself in.
If you ever find yourself in more trouble than you can handle,
he said suddenly when I had turned away and was walking towards the house.
Call my name, my full name, 3 times. I will come.
Then, in a whirl of dark purple in the twilight, he was gone. I stared at the place where he had been for a few moments, feeling strangely touched. Then, squaring my shoulders, I marched up towards the house. Vetronica Mage opened the door almost before I had finished knocking.
"Oh, I am glad to see you back," she said, shaking my hand and ushering me inside.
She was wearing the shawl Phelps had given her that morning, wrapped tightly round a plain cotton dress, and I understood why as soon as I stepped inside. The house was freezing cold. Surprised, I drew up the collar of my own coat and blew on my hands.
"It's always like this at night," she explained as she led me up to her room. "But I've made a fire in my room, so we shall be quite comfortable there."
We were comfortable, insomuch as it was warmer there, and Miss Mage had a large assortment of ragged blankets to wrap ourselves in, but the gravity of our situation weighed heavily on my mind, and we sat together in tense silence as the evening turned into proper night and the fire burned low. Around 9, when both of us were fighting the urge to nod off, I heard a distant thump down the hall. I sat bolt upright, and my companion jumped a little, and together we sat, straining our ears into the silence. But nothing more did we hear.
"Do you think perhaps I should lock the door?" she asked. I wanted to say yes. I wanted to say we should both flee, but I knew better. So instead I shook my head. I doubt it would make any difference. Nevertheless, she got up and bolted the door, and then upon further thought went over and put up the shutters as well. The wait resumed, but now we were both wide awake. Then, hours later, she let out a gasp.
Corianne, she said faintly, did you hear that?
I strained my ears, but could hear nothing.
Hear what?
I asked.
Bells, whispered Miss Mage. Bells, tolling the hour.
Which hour? I asked, getting out my pocket watch, which was reading 1:05 in the morning.
12, said she. 12 midnight.
Then, from out in the hall, I heard the telltale creak of feet upon the stair. A ghostly wind crept in under the door, bringing with it the smell of frost-covered earth and grass, and I began to feel dizzy.
No, no,
I thought desperately, and gripped the armrests of my chair for support. I could see the fairy road now, stretching out from where the door should have been, clearer than ever before. I could see every stone in that road, and to my horror, I felt for certain that the stones were watching me back. Someone was walking down the road towards us, out of wherever that road was, and into Miss Major's room. They were a raggedy, shortish someone, dressed in raggedy, waving tatters, their head bowed against an unseen wind. Then they reached the threshold of where the door should have been, and stood up. To my astonishment and dismay, Miss Mage gave a gasp of relief and delight and rose, reaching out her arms to the intruder. I stared from one to the other in disbelief, for I had never before seen such a sinister-looking person. His face was dark-skinned and pointed, with a thin, cruel mouth and wicked black eyes. His hands, which were outstretched as if to take Miss Mage into his arms, were thin and knobbly, with nails so long they had curled back on themselves and splintered. The man, or whatever he was, smiled then, a smile that stretched far wider than a normal face could have allowed, revealing row upon row of jagged yellow teeth. It was that smile which finally goaded me into action. Though my head was positively swimming by this point, I reached out a hand and blindly groped for Miss Mage, who had begun to walk towards the intruder. I caught her by the elbow and clung, holding her back. The creature looked at me, and I found I had lost the ability to speak. I wanted to tell him to go away, to leave us in peace, but nothing at all came out. It was as though I had lost my voice. The Tronica Mage was struggling in my grip, and my mind had become like a churning pot of mud. There was nothing in it that I could grasp, nothing solid or reasonable. Except the words. The words Phelps had given me. They remained, burned into the back of my head, and I clung to them in the confusion. I tried to say them, but with no voice, all that came out was a pitiful gasping sound. The creature in the doorway, on the road, chuckled and took a step down into the room. And I spoke the words. They burst forth from me like an eagle taking flight, powerful, fierce, and furious. I heard myself saying them in a voice that was not my voice, but seemed like many voices, speaking in unison, all guttural and deep, hard as granite, old as time.
Hamort Venged Olos!
The creature faltered. It stared at me with wide, hurt eyes, and then, with an anguished cry, threw itself backwards through the door and onto the road, which dissolved like mist on a hot summer morning, until there was nothing left but the door of Miss Mage's bedroom, still bolted shut, and a faint smell of brimstone. The whirling in my head ceased, and next to me Miss Mage collapsed to her knees, sobbing quietly. Then, from within the house, muffled through the walls and the door, came a terrified, strangled scream. Miss Mage's head shot up.
"That sounded like my uncle!" she gasped.
I was already unbolting the door, flinging it open and running down the stairs. Miss Mage was behind me, and she directed me through the corridors until we came to her uncle's study. The door there was also locked, but I could hear voices, low, angry voices, coming from the other side. I pounded on the wood in desperation, and to my surprise the door swung open. I stepped into the room, with Miss Mage peering anxiously over my shoulder, and stared. Phelps stood in the centre of the study, still with his hat and cane, amidst a mess of papers, pots, books, and oddments to rival his own room. He had one hand outstretched, his fingers arched into a claw as though he had grabbed hold of something invisible. Opposite him, by the wall, crouched protectively over a black scorch mark on the carpet, was the creature I had seen earlier. Judging by Miss Mage's shocked gasp, I guessed that she could now see it as I could, and whatever illusion it had cast upon her was now broken.
"You had no call to do that,"
Phelps said, and to my surprise he sounded merely irritated. The creature cringed and let out a low groan, but Phelps was unsympathetic.
"Get up," said he. "You have a lot of explaining to do."
Slowly the creature rose, and how I could have been so scared of it before I could not imagine. It looked like a small, dark-skinned man, albeit with long, pointed ears and yellow eyes, but it was so thin, and its clothes were in such a sorry state, they were mere tatters, that it looked quite harmless. In fact, it looked pitiful. It stared from Phelps, then to Miss Mage, and with a wince, to me. Then it burst into tears.
"Good grief,"
said Phelps, and carefully strode through the mess to the creature, whom he took by the elbow and led to a seat.
"Light!"
he said, and all the lamps in the room burst into life. By their illumination I saw that the scorch mark on the floor was in the shape of a man, and I knew then what had become of Miss Major's uncle.
"It's not fair!"
cried the creature, balling up its knobby hands and rubbing its eyes.
"I just finished my contract with the alchemist. Come 4 times, he said. I came 4 times, and now I want to go home."
"Stop that. It is not befitting of a fairy,"
snapped Phelps. Then he seemed to think better of it, and added in a softer voice,
"Of course you may go home. All I want is an explanation, and for you to return the children you took."
Behind me, Miss Mage let out a gasp.
"Says the magician, he says," said the fairy. "I know better than to trust your sort. Do a favour for a magician, and the next thing you know, he's treating you like his bloody famulus."
"I never held with fairy servants, not even when they were popular," Phelps said loftily. "Now, what have you done with Hollis Calhoun?"
"He's gone," said the fairy peevishly.
"And the children you took?"
The fairy looked evasive.
"Elsewhere,"
was all he said.
"Can you bring them back?"
"Maybe."
Behind me, I heard Miss Mage inhale sharply. Phelps sighed and rested a hand on the back of the chair where the fairy sat.
"Is there anything I can do to convince you to be more cooperative?"
The fairy glowered at him. Then it grinned evilly and stood up on the seat of the chair so it was eye to eye with Phelps. It stretched out a hand.
"Your hat,"
it said. Phelps looked surprised, but he reached up and took off his purple top hat, dusted it, and handed it over to the fairy without so much as a word. The fairy took it, and with a manic cackle leapt from the chair to the writing desk, raising the hat high above it.
"Now," it cried, "ladies and gentlemen, pixies and pookas, the moment you've all been waiting for."
and it reached a hand deep, deep into the hat and pulled. Cloth billowed from the hat, which resolved itself into a trouser leg, which kicked, and the next thing I knew, a young man had emerged from the hat, landed on the desk, and then tumbled to the floor. He was a stranger to me, pale and fair-haired, but Miss Mage gave a small shriek and ran forward, crying, "Saul! Saul!" But the fairy was not done. Again it reached into Phelps's hat, and this time it was a rather larger young man, with a messy mop of reddish-brown, who came tumbling out. "Oh, Bractor!" cried Miss Mage, throwing herself bodily over him. Finally the fairy reached in, and this time a young woman in a dress that once must have been very fine, but was now torn and mud-stained, appeared. She tripped over Saul, and in doing so came face to face with Miss Mage. "Vitronica?" she said in disbelief. "Mirth!" shouted all three of her siblings at once, and she was promptly buried under them. Behind and above the happy reunion, I saw the fairy offer Phelps back his hat, but he politely refused, indicating the fairy should keep it. The fairy, looking very puffed and pleased with itself, put the hat on its head at a jaunty angle, snapped its knobby fingers, and disappeared in a puff of cold morning air. "Now, now," said Phelps loudly, wading through papers and mage siblings alike. "Let us take this celebration into another room, or better yet, several rooms. This one grows rather crowded. Corian, the door, if you please." "I suspected a fairy from the beginning," Phelps told me later as we walked, all six of us, back to town in the bright spring morning. The mages had no desire to remain in that grim, forbidding house, so Phelps had wired the solicitor, William Bazelon, to meet us at our hotel in Sherndale, along with all the necessary papers. Along the way, the siblings walked together, hands joined and often getting in each other's way, but laughing when they did and sharing stories about their time apart. It appeared that Mirth, Bractor, and Saul had all been visited by a handsome man who had offered to take them away to his palace, where they would live a life of luxury and never work or go hungry again. Vitronica shivered at this description, and I knew without asking what it was that had captivated her so when the fairy had appeared. But when the other siblings arrived at his palace, they found it a mere hovel, half underground, and they were all given menial jobs and never enough to eat, and even when they were given food it was always strange and tasted odd. "Sometimes," Saul said with a shudder, "it was still moving." And he quickly changed the subject to what he wished to eat once we reached Sherndale. "It wasn't so bad," Bractor chided, slapping his brother on the back. "After all, I was only there a few months, so it can't have been that long for you."
"Months?" said Saul. "I was there for years and years." "You can't have," Vitronica piped up. "It's only been a year and a half since you left, Saul. And Bractor, you've been gone for 4 years.
Bractor frowned.
"I thought you looked older," he said.
"How old are you?" "I'm 21 today," Vitronica proclaimed proudly.
As one, the three siblings turned to their elder sister. Mirth, who had been rather quiet the whole morning, looking and breathing and seeming deeply happy, roused herself and smiled.
"Time twisted there," she said. "I ran away, you see," she added, glancing back at Phelps. "I got out of that place and lived in the forest. I could see Bractor and Saul like that, though they could never see me, or each other. I could also see time, how the fairy had turned it about and looped it over and through itself."
"Then how long were we there?" Saul demanded.
100 years, Mirth said carelessly. 1,000 years, 1 year, a month, a week, no time at all.
Vitronica understands.
Vitronica can see.
Vitronica looked across her siblings. Then her eyes widened and she gasped.
"You're all the same as when you left," she cried. "Clothes, I mean, and hair. Your hair's not grown. You're all the same age."
"We're all the same age," Bractor corrected. "Well, fancy that.
Now we can make a real troop. The amazing mages. Truly we are.
And he puffed up his chest and pranced down the road, pursued by Saul and Vetronica. Mirth lingered. She sidled up to Phelps and said, with a sparkle in her eye, I was meaning to ask earlier, but whatever did happen to our dear uncle? I had some important things to tell him when I got back. Phelps sighed regretfully.
I am sorry to say, he said, I was unable to prevent the fairy from sending him away. He is gone from this world, gone completely, and I have no doubt that the trials you and your brothers faced while in the fairy's domain will be nothing to what is awaiting him.
And with that, Mirth Mage had to be satisfied, though as she hurried on to rejoin her family, something occurred to me, and I nudged Phelps gently in the side.
Unable to prevent? I asked.
Phelps smoothed down his hair and then became very interested in picking imaginary bits of dirt off his gloves.
It did happen. Very quickly, he said after a time. I arrived in Calhoun's study not a moment before the fairy, and it was, I must say, quite agitated. We can thank your actions for that.
Mine? I gasped.
You spoke the words,
Phelps pointed out.
The words, I echoed. I could feel them still at the back of my head. What were they?
A salutation of sorts, or a dismissal. Their meaning is not as important as their form, which is in a language that even the fairies consider ancient. You've surprised it, dear Corian, and a surprised fairy is a difficult thing to anticipate. No.
He shrugged and smiled at me, full of innocent glee.
There was absolutely nothing I could have done.
The end. In addition to the rather obvious allusions to Sherlock Holmes, this story also owes some bows of recognition to the work of Susanna Clarke, whose depictions of fairies in her novel Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell greatly influenced the character of the fairy Phelps and Corian encounter here. And while I'm about thanking people, I'd also like to thank Penn and Teller. They didn't really inspire anything in the story, but they were the first people to really drive home to me the fragile wonder of stage magic and how what they do, practical magic on stage without any actual mystical magic, is actually just as admirable, just as magical in its own way, as the stunts that Bo Ragnar Phelps pulls. Now, for anyone interested in reading more about Bo Ragnar Phelps and his stunts, you can find this and all of his adventures available as ebooks online the world over in the Amazon Kindle, Barnes & Noble Nook, and iTunes iBook stores. For easy access, you can find a complete catalog of all my work on my own website at goldineogawa.com/books. Thank you for listening, and I hope you tune in, or should I say download, next week, when I'll be reading the 7th Bo Ragnar Phelps story, The Twisted Unicorn. If you want to contact me with a comment about the podcast, or if you just want to geek out about Sherlock Holmes, the original or the various television adaptations, but not the movie. We do not speak of the movie. Oh, and House doesn't count. Anyway, if you want to talk to me about that, or maybe argue with me about why House does count, send me an email at goldineogawa, that's goldeneogawa, @gmail.com. You can also tweet at me at Grimby Tweets. And also, I am on goodreads.com. Search for Goldine Ogawa or go directly to goodreads.com/Grimby Reads. If those URLs came through a little muddled, don't worry. Just check out the description attached to this podcast for all those links in easy-to-copy text form. And now, before I go, I just want to say,
Special thanks for their help in the production of Radio Grimbald go out to Marion Goldeen, my wonderful mother, Evan Ogawa, and Rachel Goldeen for creating the theme music, and of course to you for listening. Radio Grimbald is written, performed, edited, and just about everything else by me, Goldeen Ogawa. Find out more on the web at radiogrimbald.com and goldeenogawa.com. Thank you for listening, and until next week, take care and have fun.